The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
In around 2011, I received an inquiry about whether I could help this woman, Sally Challen, who had killed her husband. She had never committed a criminal offence or an act of violence in her life. To all intents and purposes, to the outside world, she seemed to be a very devoted mother and housewife. She had two grown-up sons. She expressed her love for Richard, the man whose life she took. And then one day, apparently out of the blue from perspective of family members, she took a hammer and caved her husband's head in and then drove off to a well-known suicide spot with the view of taking her own life.
Welcome to The Hearing Podcast. I'm Yasmin. It's great to have your company again. Today, I'm really excited because we are honoured to be joined by a truly inspiring guest, and her name is Harriet Wistrich. Now, Harriet is an award-winning human rights lawyer, and she's also the founder of the Centre for Women's Justice, which is an organisation dedicated to challenging violence against women and fighting for justice in the legal system. Now, you've probably heard about some of her cases because she's worked on some of the most high-profile cases advocating for survivors of domestic abuse, wrongful convictions, and police misconduct. Today, what we're going to talk about is some of those cases, those groundbreaking legal cases that she's worked on. Also, the systemic challenges faced by women seeking justice. And also, what do we need to change to create a fairer society? Harriet has worked tirelessly on campaigning on these issues, and she's really had an impact. And I cannot wait to share her insights with you.
The Hearing.
Welcome to the podcast, Harriet Wistrich. It's great to have your company. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. Let's get stuck in. You've written a fabulous book amongst many books that you've had published, Sister-in-Law. So we'll get into how you wrote that, why you wrote it. But first question, Harriet, a nice easy one for you. You've had a long career now as a lawyer and an advocate for women's rights. What actually motivated you to pursue this path?
I didn't initially decide I wanted to become a lawyer. I was pursuing other paths for a while. My main sort of motivation has always been around feminism and advocating and promoting rights of women, women's liberation, if you like, and finding different routes to do that, either through paid work or often unpaid activism and so on. And it was through a campaign that I became involved with in the early 90s around the issue of how we then described it as battered women who killed their abusers that kind of made me think about going into the law as a career. So we were campaigning around a number of cases where women had been convicted of the murder of partners who'd been violent and abusive towards them, and weren't able to have any sympathy or mitigation from the criminal courts. So they weren't able to use defences that men who killed their wives because they were nagging them or they were having an affair were more successfully able to use defences. So there was an inequality in the law around the way in which men's experience was reflected and appeased compared with when women sought to defend themselves or were pushed to extreme provocation. And we were campaigning around that. And in the course of campaigning around some individual cases, I was sitting in the Court of Appeal and I got quite interested in the law and thought, actually, maybe I should train to be a lawyer because there weren't many lawyers doing these sorts of cases and we needed good lawyers.
Yeah, that's quite a journey. And it's interesting that really piqued your interest and you decided to train as a lawyer. You took the hard road then, and you've written this really interesting book, Sister-in-Law, and you talk about some of those cases. You mentioned women who've been beaten, and I'd like to get into the Sally Challen case. Now, we've got a US audience. They may not know this case very well. Our UK listeners probably know it, but could you just tell our listeners a little bit about that case, because it became a landmark moment in recognising coercive control as a factor in domestic abuse cases. So Could you tell us a little bit about that case for our listeners?
For sure. So as I mentioned, my route into law was around these sorts of cases, actually, of women who had been driven through abuse and violence to kill their husbands or partners or abusers, and that they were being convicted of murder. They weren't able to use a full defence to murder or a partial defence. So in the UK, we have, you can either be convicted of murder, manslaughter, or acquitted. Manslaughter is a partial defence to murder, and there are a number of ways in which the gravity of the crime, if you like, is mitigated by either your mental health circumstances or by the abuse circumstances in which you committed that crime. Now, after the campaigns of the early 90s that I mentioned earlier, we thought maybe the law had improved, but we still kept seeing women being convicted of murder. And throughout my legal career, I've been contacted at various times by women or families of women who have been convicted of murder in such circumstances. So in around 2011, I received an inquiry about whether I could help this woman, Sally Challen, who had killed her husband. And it was completely out of the blue. She had never committed a criminal offence or an act of violence in her life. To all intents and purposes, to the outside world, she seemed to be a very devoted mother and housewife. She had two grown-up sons. She expressed her love for Richard, the man whose life she took. And then one day, apparently out of the blue, from the perspective of family members, she took a hammer and caved her husband's head in and then drove off to a well-known suicide spot with the view of taking her own life. And she was talked down, and then she was tried and convicted of his murder. The question for me was, is there a way of appealing this conviction? And what her family said was, it was out of the blue, but he was a very controlling man. She was completely and utterly submissive to his every whim. And they felt that there was something about that dynamic of the relationship that led her to take that very extreme act. I then explored with her the history and background of that relationship to try and come to an understanding of what had driven this woman, who still, even after his death, professed her love for him, which was quite weird, but what had driven her to kill him. And, you know, the pattern that emerged was one that he was completely controlling over every aspect of her life. And she just could see no way to continue to exist after nearly 30 years of marriage to him. And it was him continually gaslighting her and telling her one thing when he was obviously doing the opposite that had driven her to a kind of moment of madness in some ways. But how did we appeal? How could we approach an appeal against conviction? And you can't just appeal a conviction because you say it's wrong. You've got to find some sort of fresh evidence. And it was whilst I was examining that story that I became aware of a new law that was being debated in Parliament that then came into force in 2015, which was the criminalisation of coercive and controlling behaviour. Coercive and controlling behaviour is a different way of really understanding abusive relationships because it looks at a whole series of different acts in a relationship which, whilst separately, may not amount to criminal acts in themselves, but when taken together as a whole pattern of control and abuse, may be such that they essentially entrap somebody so utterly within their relationship that they lose their sense of self and their sense of liberty. And that new crime, a new way of understanding abuse seemed to me to be a way in which you could understand Sally's behaviour, if you like, and her reaction and what had led her in those circumstances. So we tried to develop this argument in the which eventually got to the Court of Appeal about the fresh way of understanding domestic abuse that amounted to a sort of form of fresh evidence. And in fact, eventually, after a long battle, which took several years, the Court of Appeal did allow her appeal. And she was then sent for a retrial, but eventually the prosecution service accepted a plea to manslaughter. Now, in fact, the coercive controlling behaviour wasn't itself a defense, but it was the impact of that on her mental health and the way in which her mental health contributed to her level of responsibility that amounted to the grounds of appeal that were eventually allowed.
Yeah. And we're very familiar now with that language, coercive control, but this is back in 2015. It just wasn't in the lexicon, really. We didn't really use those words. And I believe this is in the UK, the Archers, which has been going on for years on Radio 4, had a storyline, didn't they, about two people in a relationship, and we could recognise that was coercive control, that relationship. And that was quite timely, in fact, that there's a more public awareness about different forms of abuse, not necessarily just physical, but also emotional, psychological abuse, which would amount to coercive control as well.
As part of a pattern, yeah. Mm. The coercive control sometimes is mistaken for psychological abuse. It does include, it's a very strongly psychological element, but it's about a pattern of control. Yeah.
And so Sally Challen, that's one chapter in your really excellent book, Sister-in-Law, which I keep mentioning because I think everybody should buy it. But what I said to you before, Harriet, is I love the way that there's a lot of storytelling. So you're immediately gripped as the reader. I actually listened to it on Audible. So it's about these individuals that you begin to care about and learn about their histories. But it's not just about these individuals. It's about the wider impact on society, particularly women, how the law can really treat them unfairly because sometimes they need a different kind of treatment. And that's what I found really fascinating. It draws you into the personal, but actually it has wider implications for society at large. So what inspired you to write the book? What is it that you want readers to take away as well from the stories that you share?
Yes, I mean, it's a good question because I never particularly had an ambition to write a book, but it was because I had a series of quite significant cases that were quite high profile, and quite a few people kept saying, you must write a book, you must write a book. And I thought, I haven't really got time to write a book because I've got a very busy job. But eventually I thought, I'll take a plunge. And so I put together a proposal and it snapped up by a publisher. And then I thought, how am I going to fit this in with my job? So I carved out some bits of time during the working week to work on the book. And over a period of a year or so, I just started kind of reflecting on the cases and writing it up. And actually, I found the whole process a very reflective process for me because it really made me think about how I do the law, why I do the law, how the law can change things. And I'm very much, as I describe in the book, a lawyer that's driven not by the love of the law, but by a love of justice and about looking at ways in which to achieve just results, whether the law allows it or not, if you like, or finding routes around. So it was reflective in terms of my methodology, I suppose, as well, and about how the way in which I approach these sorts of cases, which is very much client-led, I suppose. It's very much about listening to and really working from the story of the client first and foremost, but it's also about a collaborative approach, and it's about not just seeing yourself as an expert in the law, but thinking about what other input can I take, whether it's working sometimes with the media is a useful thing to do. Sometimes it's with academic expertise or the frontline service providers who have that day-to-day understanding of the issues that abuse victims and survivors have to live with, and just bringing all of that together in the approach to the legal cases.
Yeah. That's why you got into the law in the first place. You were motivated by a very personal story. So that must have been a really cathartic experience, writing the book and really re-examining the why you do what you do. And, you know, you do get very close to your clients as well. And there's a lot of hand-holding. It's not just about the law, is it? And I believe one of the victims, which you mentioned in the book, actually stayed with you afterwards, didn't she? Was that Emma?
Emma Humphrey. That was really the first big case I was involved in. And that was the case that I did the transition from being a campaigner to a lawyer. And it was a young woman who'd also killed a very violent partner. And she'd come from a very difficult, complex childhood. She was only 17 when she was convicted of murder, and she'd been in prison by the time the appeal came up, because it was a long time before she even thought that she was entitled to any justice. But by the time she contacted us after 7 years and then her appeal, she'd been in prison for 10 years, but she was still very much a child, and she didn't have much of a support mechanism. She came out into the world without that. And initially she did stay at our house for a little while, but it was a bit, she was quite wild, really. Yeah. And we looked for ways to get her support. And it was harder after she got out than before, unfortunately.
Yeah. She had really quite a damaged history, I understand.
Yeah, very much.
When you read into that, you understand why she ended up in the situation she did end up in, and have a lot of empathy for her situation. Really difficult.
The hearing.
You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes, every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
You've divided the book into various chapters, and the chapter I found fascinating was about the undercover police that sometimes infiltrate movements. And there's been lots of programs about this on TV, but can you tell us a little bit more about the undercover police and why you wrote that chapter?
Yeah, I mean, this was an extraordinary case. So after I qualified as a lawyer, as well as doing some of these criminal appeals that we've been talking about, I also started specialising in quite a niche area of law, which was about holding the police accountable. We used to call it actions against the police law. And it was about police being sometimes wrongfully arresting people or using violence, but also about, as I started applying my sort of feminist interest to it, it was also about failures in policing as well. But this particular case, which again, I started probably around the same time as Sally Chan case in about 2011, was this what turned out to be this extraordinary story, which has now been exposed, but was for 40 years hidden from public view, about a very secretive part of British policing that was involved in intelligence gathering in relation to mainly political protest groups. Now, it had been set up in 1968 at the time that there was a lot of political agitation around the Vietnam War, and there were some huge protests in London, and the Home Office and the police were all quite worried about how do they police this public order. And they set up this secret unit within the Metropolitan Police, which was to gather intelligence by sending undercover police officers deep undercover to find out what was being planned by the organisers. Now, that started, as I say, in the 60s, but then it just, because it was so secret and even people in the police didn't know it existed, they just started, it became really a bit of a rogue unit, and they just were infiltrating all sorts of organisations. These were mainly democratic movements. They weren't terrorists. They weren't serious criminal. The worst sort of criminal thing might be some stopping traffic or a bit of criminal damage or whatever, but nothing that sort of seriously threatened people or the state in a major way. But they were sending these officers in to gather intelligence to try and disrupt their legitimate protests. Now, as a result of these officers being undercover for so many years, many of them, it then transpires, decided that they could have sexual relationships mainly with women in these movements, because most of the officers were men. And a number of them ended up being involved in relationships for 3, 4, 5 years. One or two even had children with them. And then these men, when they're at the end of their deployment, which usually lasted 5 or 6 years, they'd be pulled and said, that's it, you're leaving, that's the end of your job. And so they'd disappear from these women's lives, vanish. And when they did that, in order to sort of not create suspicion, they would feign things like a mental breakdown. And so the women who had these sort of what they believe was very loving relationships with these men who were very attentive, because the men were playing a role, they could play the part of a very attentive boyfriend, if you like. So they got in there quite quickly, and the women thought they'd met somebody who was like, my gosh, this man really pays attention to me, and blah, 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 blah. And then they would just completely vanish from their lives, feigning a breakdown. So the women would then think, oh my God, what's happened? Why has he suddenly vanished? They would look for him, and everything that he said about himself turned out not to be true, or there was no evidence. So they'd think, I never really met his family, but he mentioned his uncle who lived in so-and-so place. And so she'd go and search, and there'd be no evidence of the uncle. There'd be no, you know, that, you know, he worked in this, you know, timber yard, but there was no evidence that he'd ever worked there, et cetera, et cetera. So unsurprisingly, these women were left in a completely frightened and quite paranoid state. These various women realized that they were right and that they had been targeted by these police spies. And they came together to take legal action against the police. And I worked with a group of eight of them in a case that lasted a few years.
It's mind-boggling, absolutely astonishing. First, why, as you say, they're not terrorist groups, they're activist groups. I don't understand the motivation for trying to gain intelligence in those groups. And then the level of deceit that these women, how they would trust anyone again, and having children with some of these men, it's absolutely astonishing. Do you think it's still going on today, undercover?
We know that undercover policing is used for perhaps more legitimate reasons, yes, like gathering intelligence on serious organised crime or terrorism and so on. But the question really is, what is there to stop undercover officers from having intimate sexual relationships with women within the communities that they're spying on? And there is no, despite the campaign so far by the women, there's no kind of absolute law prohibiting that. The guidance is that they shouldn't, but they're not being prosecuted. No one's been prosecuted for doing what many of the women feel was like a rape, that level of deception. They would never have had a relationship with a man or a sexual intimacy with a man if they knew he was a police officer gathering intelligence on them and their friends. So, yeah,
unbelievable. Another chapter that you did in the book was about the John Warboys case. Again, our US listeners may not be familiar. I'm sure UK listeners know this case very well. But that raised serious questions about how the justice system handles serial sexual offenders. Firstly, Harriet, would you kindly just briefly give an overview of what John Warboys' case was about? And then I'll ask you another question about that.
Yeah, sure. As I mentioned, I looked at police taking action or holding the police accountable generally. And one of the issues was whether police failures to investigate crimes could be something that was actionable by under the law. And historically, that has been tested in law. So just going back to another case, which was quite a famous case in the 70s and 80s, involving a man known as the Yorkshire Ripper, who had raped him, well, no, had murdered many women in the streets of West Yorkshire. And there was a terrible police failures about the investigation into him. But the mother of one of his last victims, who tried to hold the police accountable, was unsuccessful. And it was said that you can't sue the police in negligence. So this has been a big, you know, for their failures to investigate. So this has been a big legal difficulty. But what happened was I was approached by two women separately who were victims of a man called John Warboys. John Warboys was a taxi driver. He drove a black cab in London, and he used to collect women, pick up women, lone women often, outside nightclubs in central London. That was his modus operandi. When he picked them up, so sometimes there's a chance they'd had a few drinks anyway, but he would come up with this sort of patter. So he had this real happy, chatty technique as a cabbie that often they do. And so he'd talk to them and he'd say, look, guess what? I've just won some money on the lottery. And he'd show them a wad of cash that he'd just won and said, would you have a drink? Would you have a drink to celebrate with me? And a lot of the women were like, that's all right, mate. Yeah, but he was very pushy. And just to be polite, often they'd accept a sip of a drink. And what he'd done was lace that drink with a concoction of drugs that often rendered them unconscious. And then he would sexually assault or rape them in the back of the cab. And then he'd drop them off back at their homes. He'd take their keys and try and put them in their home or whatever and leave them there. And the women would wake up in the morning completely confused about what had happened, what they'd just blacked out, but often thinking, you know, having these flashback memories or realizing that they'd been sexually assaulted or raped. But what would anyone think? Would anyone believe them? That just seemed extraordinary. And it was a cabbie. Over a period of what was several years, this man, it later transpired, had attacked well over 100 women. And about 10 over a period of 6 years had actually reported him to the police. On each occasion, the police did very kind of limited investigations and were skeptical and just thought maybe he just had too much to drink. You can't really remember it. Would a black cab driver really risk his license? Those sorts of responses. And they just didn't push the investigation very far. Eventually what happened was that somebody in the police was doing a sort of a dip sampling thing and just suddenly saw all these reports where there's this incredibly similar modus operandi being used. And it was as a result of that that eventually, pulling the cases that had been reported together, he was, and then putting out a public appeal and many more victims coming forward, that he was prosecuted and convicted. But the women and the two clients that I work with who had reported him obviously were pleased that he was eventually convicted, but they felt really aggrieved and distressed by the way they were treated by the police, particularly because they felt that because the police didn't believe them, or they felt the police didn't believe them, he had gone off to do and commit so many more crimes. And as most women who report rape will tell you, and certainly have told me, they're mainly reporting because they think this man could do it again and they don't want him to do it again. And that, you know, reporting a rape is not on anyone's account something you want to do for fun. It is a very difficult, hard process. You have to be, as well as the physical examination and so on, you have to repeat some very deeply horrendous stories. So you're not going to do that unless you think that you have a duty to do it, or you want to stop other women being his victim. And that's what those women did. And it was the police failures that had caused him, allowed him to go on to do all these crimes. And it was that those failures actually impacted more on them in some ways than the actual rape itself. So they wanted to hold the police accountable. Now, as I explained at the beginning of that passage, there is no way in which you can hold the police accountable in negligence. However, we had in 2000 passed the Human Rights Act, and there was another route that we built up. So it became quite an important legal precedent, but we established that the duty created through the Human Rights Act to prevent citizens from being subjected to torture and inhumane and degrading treatment, which puts a duty on the state to have a system of laws in place and to operate those laws effectively, had been breached in this case. So the state had failed through its failure to implement laws to protect citizens from rape and sexual abuse, had failed. And that amounted to a violation of Article 3 of the European Convention of Human Rights. And therefore, they were vindicated in court by that judgment that there was a violation. And that's then created a precedent that this is a way of holding the police accountable where they fail in their investigations.
Yeah. And in terms of how we ensure that victims, like War Boys victims, are heard and believed, how can the legal system improve its approach? Is also part of the solution having more female police officers in interviewing those victims? Because I believe a lot of them were men and they just simply maybe didn't ask the right questions or may had an attitude where the women felt, you're not really believing me, which adds insult to injury. So how can we improve that side of things for women going through this experience?
Yeah, I don't think, obviously, potentially a female officer can be better, but I have to say from talking to many women who've been through the system, they're not necessarily any better. It's the attitude and the understanding and the trauma-informed approach. And, I mean, there have been so many efforts over the years to try and improve the response of police and the criminal justice system to rape and sexual abuse. And there have been initiatives. In fact, there's a big initiative going on at the moment, which is called Operation Soteria, which is about refocusing, ensuring that rape and sexual abuse investigations are focused on building a case against the suspect, as opposed to looking at ways to discredit the victim. And that's been the problem throughout in sexual abuse cases, that instead of the police looking at how can, you know, here's a case of a serious offence, what evidence can we build up to try and convict this person? Instead, what they're doing, what they do, and this comes from a deeply misogynistic patriarchal society that blames victims, is just saying, why did you get into that situation? What were you doing? Look at the way you were seen to behaving on CCTV. You had too much to drink. And just thinking about that as the response, rather than, oh my God, you've been a victim, outrageous, let's now see what we can build up from your account to mount a potential prosecution.
Yeah, because the prosecution rate is so low, isn't it?
You
know, what is it? I can't remember the actual statistic now, but it's not shifted in many, many years.
No, it is tiny. It's like 2-3% of reported rapes that are charged. It's unbelievably low. It is a challenge, because I think partly more women have come forward because we've had all these sort of campaigns, Me Too and various things, and more women probably do report, but it's still a small proportion of those that are attacked that actually report. And then there's so many cases, and to properly resource and investigate and prosecute those cases, those resources don't exist in our criminal justice system. So that's part of the problem. But a lot of the problem is also about approach and will and training and understanding and a commitment to tackling, seeing this sort of form of violence as something that is so fundamental. It's about women being treated as equal citizens in society, really.
Yeah. And Harriet, as you look back on your career, I mean, you've still got a long career ahead of you, but have there been any special achievements? I mean, there've been so many, you've listed so many of them in the book, of the cases you've been involved with, really high profile cases, but any for you that stand out that you really remember and are really proud of those cases, or anything that sticks in your mind that you want to share with us?
I think all the cases we've talked about have been really, really important cases. And yeah, I'm proud of what we achieved in those cases and in some of the other cases I've been involved in, that I tell those stories in the book. I also talk about one case which wasn't so much about violence against women. It was actually about the shooting dead of a Brazilian man on the underground. So the Jean-Charles de Menezes case, which was quite a huge case to manage, and that kind of taught me a lot. And then I did a lot of work around women and people, actually, in immigration detention and the terrible treatment they were subjected to, and looking at accountability around that. And yeah, and around women who were historically convicted of prostitution offences when they were often still children, and how that has blighted their lives for many years. So there's a number of different cases that I describe in the book, and about issues around criminalization of victims of rape as well.
Yeah. So to wrap up, final question, what kind of change do you hope your book will bring in terms of public awareness or policies change? What do you want your readers to be left with?
One is just to, I think storytelling is often the way to help people understand the issues and the law, And so it's a route into understanding violence against women, misogyny, the criminal justice system and the failures. I hope it's also a bit of an inspiration to how you can sometimes use the law to change things. And, you know, that I've set up a legal charity called the Centre for Women's Justice. So that's sort of my current career, is running that charity. And that charity is very much aimed at holding the state accountable around violence against women and girls and challenging discrimination in the criminal justice system. So we're trying to spread the learning that I and others who've done this sort of area of work to make it something that, you know, as part of the overall different tools that we can use to challenge male violence against women, seeing legal challenges and holding institutions accountable is an important part of that overall project.
Thank you, Harriet. You've been a fantastic guest. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
The Hearing.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did. And as usual, we'd love to hear from you with your feedback or any suggestions on future guests via thehearing@tr.com.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.